The Lifeboat Hour with Michael Rupert, Sundays at 9 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome everyone, welcome to the Lifeboat Hour. It's my great pleasure tonight to be sitting in for Mike Rupert. This is Carolyn Baker, and Mike is tonight giving a sold-out lecture on collapse in Portland as we speak. He'll be back next week, but we have a great show for you tonight. We're going to be talking in depth about collapse as it has showed up in the extreme weather of Hurricane Irene in the northeastern United States last month. And next week, Mike is going to be interviewing Carolyn Staton, who's the Executive Director of Transition U.S., and that will be, I'm sure, a very, very good show next week. Now, as many of you know, Mike and I are old friends, and we go way back to the early years of this decade when we both began, well, he actually began in 1978 looking at world events together. I caught up with him in 2000. And for a time, I was Mike's managing editor at From the Wilderness. Before I get into talking with our guest tonight, who I think is going to be a very exciting attraction on this show this evening, I'd like to share with our listeners in the Northeast that I'm going to be touring Vermont September 21 through 25. And we're focusing on Vermont tonight and the destruction in the Northeast around Irene. I'm going to be traveling there and speaking in Burlington, Montpelier, Randolph Center, and making myself available for one-on-one conversations and collapse coaching throughout those 5 days. This will be my first visit to Vermont since 2009, and I'm greatly looking forward to reconnecting with old friends and new friends and learning more about how the state is navigating the recent disaster caused by Irene. So for specifics on where I will be and when, please visit my website at www.carolynbaker.net. That's Carolyn with a Y, www.carolynbaker.net. Now, this past weekend, I had the extraordinary pleasure of joining with my friends Susie Gruber and Jerry Allen in Sebastopol, California, to offer a Living Resiliently workshop there, which was an amazing opportunity for every one of us to discover the resources that we all have in dealing with collapse. Susie and Jerry and I are going to be in Chico, California for another Living Resiliently workshop in October, on October the 15th. You can learn more about that by going to Susie's website at www.susiegruber.com. That's spelled S-U-Z-I-E Gruber, G-R-U-B-E-R, susiegruber.com. Also, if you've not read my books, Sacred Demise, Walking the Spiritual Path of Industrial Civilization's Collapse, or Navigating the Coming Chaos, A Handbook for Inner Transition, you're missing out on what are probably two of the only books in print focused on emotional and spiritual preparation for collapse. Both can be ordered at my website, carolynbaker.net, or downloaded on Kindle at Amazon. Very, very little is out there being offered in the way of emotional and spiritual preparation for the largest convergence of crises in the history of the human race. And my entire life and work these days is about providing that kind of preparation. As many CollapseNet readers already know, I write a regular column on CollapseNet called Collapsing Consciously, which offers regular nuggets of material for emotional and spiritual preparation for collapse. In addition, I offer collapse coaching long distance or on Skype. Many, many people have contacted me this past year to talk about how to prepare for collapse, how to reskill themselves, how to hook up with and build community so they're not doing preparation alone, how to relocate. And one of the really big issues, how do I deal with my family and friends who think I'm crazy, who don't want to hear about collapse? Sometimes it really helps to talk to someone about this, someone who's been studying collapse for a long time and has the training to coach you in making these enormous changes in your life. So if that's something that fits for you, email me at carolyn@carolynbaker.net. Now, I'm really excited tonight about our guest, who is a Vermont State senatorial candidate. His name is Robert Wagner. And he's going to give us an update on the situation in Vermont and help us connect the dots with the larger picture of collapse in general. So let me tell you just a bit about Robert. He's a mountain homesteader in Vermont and a business consultant. He's running for the Vermont Senate in 2012 on a platform of home rule, liberty, and limited constitution government. Robert is greatly concerned for Vermont's survival, and he's part of a 30 for Senate campaign to take back the entire Vermont Senate. He intends to devolve state power back to Vermont's towns and villages as it was before 1962. His methods are to speak the truth and be around after the legislature in Montpelier leaves Vermont in disgrace once the federal handouts dry up and there's nothing left after allowing international corporations to loot our commonwealth. Vermont, Robert feels, is going to be on its own. And I have a feeling that this conversation is going to evoke a lot of questions from listeners. I understand that we're having technical difficulties this evening with the phone lines, but you can email your questions to me anytime during the show. Carolyn, that's with a Y, C-A-R-O-L-Y-N, Carolyn@carolynbaker.net, and let us know what you would like to ask Robert, okay? So, welcome to the show, Robert.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Yes, it's wonderful to have you here. Talk to us a little bit about Vermont independence. What is that?
Well, Vermont independence is, it means a lot of things to a lot of people. I should tell you, for folks that live outside of Vermont, that Vermont's run much in the same way as an Indian reservation is. So corporations come in, they take our groundwater, they take our minerals, they take just about everything that there is to take, and then we have to subsist on handouts. So the governance of Vermont is not what you think it is. It's not the green paradise that you think it is. It's more like a third world country or an Indian reservation. So there are not very many economic opportunities here. In fact, I have to work outside of Vermont just to make a living.
Now, say more about corporations coming in and taking resources. Can you give us some examples of that?
Oh, here's a very good example. Vermont is a major source of groundwater. So our groundwater is mined out. Companies like Nestle, Perrier, Coca-Cola come in here, take as much as they want, and pay nothing in taxes. I have to tell you that Alaska, for instance, had decided to tax their oil. I mean, what an original idea. And they cancel the state income tax, and they distribute a dividend check to every Alaskan. But in Vermont, we've done the opposite because our natural resources don't benefit us one jot. Same with the logging, the minerals, the marble that's extracted from the ground. We have to, with public money, create roads and railroads for these companies so they can take our marble out, but they don't pay for what they take.
Now, how come the state allows them to do that if the state isn't getting anything out of it?
State's run by a corrupt political machine, always was.
Mm-hmm.
And what you have to understand about Vermont is that not much has changed in a long time in that respect. So there's an incredible amount of money being spent on lobbying. Our state legislature has no staff, but lobbyists provide the staff.
That's really interesting. I wasn't aware of that lobbyists actually provide the staff.
Yep, they provide staff services, they provide research services, they tell our legislature everything they need to know to make informed decisions.
Wow. Is that atypical of other states?
I couldn't tell you about other states. I think they vary. For example, North Dakota has a state bank. They've taken control of their own finances, and as a result, they haven't been affected quite as badly as other states by the 2008 crash. And as I mentioned about Alaska, is that they have a natural resources severance tax. So companies actually have to pay for what they take.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a wise thing to shift taxes away from production of things, from the manufacture of things, to simply taking natural resources. So there's two different tax models, and Vermont's the only state which does not have a severance tax of any kind for resources.
So who would you say is profiting from the resources being extracted from Vermont besides the corporations that are extracting them?
Well, Vermont does not benefit one jot from that. There is no revenue.
Are you suggesting that politicians are benefiting?
I think they don't know. They just don't know any other way. And sad part is that they're not listening to us.
Mm-hmm.
Because the budget was $400 million out of whack in 2010, and they got a federal bailout for that. They just didn't know what to do, and it bought the election for the Democrats. So they don't really know what to do, but it became plain in running for office and talking to people, there's a great deal of frustration. They're not listening to Vermonters. So, for example, UVM, University of Vermont, Gund Institute, documented all of this about the natural resources, laid it out in front of the legislature. They ignored it and hired a commission of, largely political hacks to tell them what they wanted to hear, which was to raise taxes, bump the middle class up a few tax brackets, and pretty much keep things as they are.
Right. Now, when I lived in Vermont a couple of years ago, I was involved with the independence movement, and, a lot of people, usually progressive people, have very weird ideas about secession. Some people think that it means the same thing in Vermont as it would in Texas or Montana. So I'd like you to clarify for us what it means, because I'm very sure it doesn't mean that all of a sudden Vermont is going to stand up and beat on its chest and scream, "We are seceding." So what does secession mean to you, and why is it important?
Well, the chest beating is that's a rather silly thing, and that's a good insight, because it is very different. Vermont and other states simply have a different history. Vermont was never a colony. We were actually, like Texas, an independent republic, and we've kept this independent spirit for a long time. Now, we debated secession at two points in the state house in our history. One was during the War of 1812, again, because of the conscription, and during the Fugitive Slave Act. Vermont's constitution explicitly forbids slavery. and that the Fugitive Slave Act was such a heinous thing that we actually debated leaving, and then the Civil War broke out, and the debate suddenly stopped.
Right.
So we've got an interesting history, but I would tell you that it's nothing like you might find in the South. What I would say about Vermont is that we consider the real secessionists in the independence movement in Vermont. We consider the real secessionists to be the people in Washington D.C. who have seceded from our Constitution.
Who've seceded from the United States Constitution?
They've seceded from the United States Constitution. They're not mm-hmm. following it. This is
right.
the law of the land. And at some point, if things get so bad, we just might have to leave.
Right.
But free association is free association. And to have a federal government, they have to be doing their jobs. They have to be following the law of the land. And they have to be competitive for us to want to do business with them.
Right.
So that's how we see it.
So when Rick Perry stands up in Texas and says, you know, well, if you guys mess with us much more, we might have to secede, that's a whole different kind of secession, isn't it?
That's the saber-rattling brand of secession.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look at his record, and he's big government through and through. He's
right.
a machine politician who you really got to watch how they vote. He was for the bailouts, and he took care of his friends.
Right.
So when you see these guys saber rattling, it's hard to take them seriously, but the media do.
Well, I think the situation is a little different in Montana. They too have talked about seceding, but I think probably for different reasons. And
yeah.
what I know of the secession movement in Vermont is that it's extremely progressive. It's not about, we just want to be on our own and that's it. It's made up of people who really understand that invariably, inevitably, as you have said, we're going to be on our own. So I want to ask the next question, but in the meantime, I want to invite callers to email me at carolyn@carolynbaker.net for any questions that you have for Robert. I think that we're going to, as we progress here, we're going to get into some pretty interesting stuff. So I'd like to bring this up to the present moment and ask you to tell us more about what has happened in Vermont as a result of the devastating floods brought about by Irene.
Okay, well, it's devastating indeed. In Vermont, we have a lot of houses and roads in the floodplains and in the paths of shifting rivers. So in a shifting climate, where hurricanes happen more and more often, you can see very clearly in the photographs the way the roads were built. Asphalt over dirt, and then the dirt gets eaten away from below the road until there's only a thin shell on top, and you see that thin shell flaking away. So much of our infrastructure was not very solidly built, and some of it was simply built in the wrong place. The cheapest place to build a road is right next to the river, but it's also the most transient place. So will we learn from that? That's a very good question.
Right. How are people right now dealing with the devastation? How are local neighborhoods and communities responding to this?
Well, I've had feet on the ground here, since the hurricane. What's been immediately obvious is that we're not prepared. We have no disaster preparedness here in Vermont. Our Vermont Guard has been sacrificed to the Afghanistan war effort. I mean, these are kids that have been sent to Afghanistan and paired off with crack Macedonian troops. and you know who's going to get killed first. So nine of us guardsmen were killed in Iraq, and I'm sorry, Afghanistan, and two more guardsmen in Iraq. Our guard, National Guard equipment, is currently in Iraq, so we had nothing. So when the so the New Jersey National Guard came, they were delivering some equipment. They were flying the VIPs around. We had the Maine National Guard providing, doing the technical stuff, trying to put, keep rivers back, trying to get people, trying to do search and rescue. Vermont and New Hampshire share a single medevac helicopter. So this gives you the, I hope this is painting a picture for you.
Wow, yeah, that's huge.
Yeah, we have no disaster preparedness.
And, okay,
there's a positive aspect to this, is that we very quickly realize that we're on our own. Collapse is not a future event, it's something that's unfolding now. So communities pulled together. And I think that the most telling part was that after 3 days when Governor Shumlin had finally declared a state of emergency in Vermont, he waited until Wednesday. The hurricane was on Sunday. So Shumlin's being shuttled around in a New Jersey National Guard helicopter, and he's walking around Moortown with a state senator and a state rep, asking people what they thought of the flood. How do you feel? What do you think? And one guy came up and told him, if it wasn't for the community, rather than waiting for help, we would all be dead. The governor didn't like that too much.
Right. Let's hold it right there, Robert. Hold
sure.
that thought, and we'll be right back in just a few seconds.
Between horizon and events, taking time to breathe the day, it's time to go out and
don't bother me.
Listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Dr. Peter Bregan, author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness. Listen to my newly syndicated talk show, The Dr. Peter Bregan Hour, and find out why they call me the conscience of psychiatry. Hear my cutting-edge guests expose the dangers of conventional psychiatric diagnosis, drugs, and shock treatment. Learn about better ways, better therapeutic and spiritual approaches to healing ourselves and to making the most of our lives in a responsible, loving, and creative manner. Make your life turn out the way you want. Join me every 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, live or on the archive at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Don't miss out on Dr. Michio Kaku's weekly show, Explorations. Dr. Kaku is the only scientist with his own nationally syndicated radio show. Explorations is the program that explains complex physics with an accessible approach. So take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to discuss topics ranging from space exploration to stem cell research.
Listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back, everyone. We're talking this evening with Robert Wagner, who is a 2012 candidate for the Vermont Senate And he's talking to us about the damage from Hurricane Irene in Vermont. And I was just asking him how the people are responding to this. And I'd like you to say more about how local neighborhoods and communities are dealing with this devastation.
Well, they are. People are just doing what's needed and teaming up, pooling their resources. And it's happening spontaneously, according to the old New England town organizational model, our town meeting. That's the basic governance unit, and it seems to be the one that's the most efficient. So everything from deciding, you know, what to, you know, where to put what road to fix first, or you know, where, what people to help out first, and how to do the triage. Everything is being done locally. Nothing is being, practically nothing is being dictated or planned from above. And what's, anything that's being accomplished is being accomplished on the ground by communities, by small towns, not by FEMA or anybody else.
Can you give us an example of how a small town is doing that? I'm familiar, as you know, with Rochester and Hancock in that area, and somewhat with Randolph, because I lived in Randolph. Choose one of those places and tell us how they're actually doing that.
Well, Hancock is the next town over from me. I'm up in the mountains, and they're down by the river. And the river came through and washed out a few bridges and roads, and essentially cut them off on all sides. And people simply showed up at the town meetings, which were held twice a day, and decided, local volunteer fire departments played a part in the organization. Whatever needed to be done was done, and people did it.
Right.
And that it had to, you know, even with transporting, medical patients out to bringing in drinking water.
Doing it all themselves.
Doing it all themselves. Food collection and distribution in churches, clothing distribution, you name it. Everything that society needed to go on living and not drown in its own filth was done.
Right. What an incredible model this is for what we're going to need to do in collapse, what we're going to have to do around the country in the face of a lot of extreme weather that is going to be increasing because of climate change. We know that this is just one of many in a long string of extreme weather incidents that are brought about by climate change that people are going to have to respond to on their own. So I just want to be clear, were there any disaster funds that were allocated from the federal government that you're aware of?
Well, on Sunday there were numerous states that had declared disasters. Vermont, for some reason, waited until Wednesday, and there are funds available. People can apply to FEMA. There are private assessors going around looking at damages, and they can put in claims. And I have no idea what will happen after that. I mean, you got to do whatever you have to do and get whatever you can get, obviously.
Right.
But it's not something that we are depending on, especially after there have been some local incidents with FEMA. For example, in Woodstock, Vermont, FEMA came in and threw a group out of the church so they could set up a command post, and that group was using the church as a dry place to distribute clothing and food. And FEMA wanted to set up desks and computers and bring their people in. So, you know, there's a certain amount of the money that's being spent is, of course, going into bureaucracy. I don't see how a lot of it helps. There's hard items such as electrical substations. For example, there were electrical substations that were built in the floodplain and washed away, and the lesson is you don't put your substation in the floodplain. So
right.
Substations were provided. I don't know where they came from, and a lot of people have their electricity back at the moment.
Right. Well, as we know, and it's been published on CollapseNet and a lot of other places, I think the original source of the story was CNNMoney.com, and I published it on my Daily News Digest. FEMA's essentially broke, and I wrote an article for Collapsing Consciously on the CollapseNet website. My last article was, is her name Irene or Katrina? Because so much of this on a smaller scale reminds me of Katrina in terms of the way it's being handled by the federal government.
I understand. I have not taken a close look at FEMA, and, you know, not many people have. It just doesn't seem relevant
right.
for our lives here in Vermont.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting because as I talk with you, I think about the fact that a lot of progressive people think that because Vermont is brimming with progressive ideas and has a Democratic governor and a Democratic U.S. senator and an independent U.S. senator, that it's headed in a progressive direction. Can you tell us why it isn't headed in a progressive direction? In conversations with you this past summer, you've suggested that these so-called progressive politicians have, in fact, sold out Vermont to corporations. So I'm going to ask you to say more about this, but before I do, I just want to ask our listeners, please email me any questions that you have for Robert at carolyn@carolynbaker.net. So tell us more about this, so-called progressive politicians in Vermont.
Well, there's a very handy website out there called votesmart.org. And if you go to votesmart.org, you can put in your zip code and see who all of your national and local representatives are, and then click on that person and see how they voted, how they performed, what they actually did. So I found myself not listening to their rhetoric at all, and just looking at what they do. And then you take a guy like Bernie Sanders, pretends to be a person who is a friend of the working class. And as it turns out, number one, he's not working class, and number two, he has consistently supported the wars. He's supported the wars, and he's voted to fund those wars. So the cost of war, of those wars to Vermont since 2001 has been about, it's been almost $2 billion, which is a lot of money for a small state that works out to, $11,000 for a family of four. We don't have that kind of money.
Right.
The poor state, 10% are below the poverty line. So, Welch, Leahy, you look at their records, they are war hawks.
Right.
And if you, look at their votes and look at what they've done, you can see that they're working for companies like Monsanto. They're working in Monsanto's interests to over-regulate farming to the extent where small farmers can't cope anymore. We lose 2 small farms a week. In fact, I think the number of small farms in Vermont just dipped below the 1,000 threshold.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So there's, you just have to, you'll look at what they do rather than what they say, because what they do, they act like they're your friend, and they ride the political tides, and they're, you know, vote for us because we're looking after your interests, and you know, and with in a Congress that's, oh, they're so corrupt, and you know, there's not much we could do, but we did our best. And so people have faith in them just because he's our boy.
Right. You know, a lot has been made a few months back, earlier this year, a lot was made of the so-called single-payer health care in Vermont. What's really happening with that?
What's really happening with that is we can't afford it. I have, you know, to me, I look at the kinds of things that are subsidized in most states, and cars are subsidized. Roads are built for cars, and nobody thinks twice about it. We barely build any public transport, but we subsidize big oil in so many ways, and we take it for granted. But now it becomes a big argument about whether we should be paying for universal health care or not. Well, right now we have the money to pay for universal health care, you know, if we were to make corporations pay their taxes, but that's not going to happen, so we don't have the money to pay for it. So it seems to me, and I may be wrong, to be a lot of posturing on the part of our state politicians who are hoping that more funds will be forthcoming from Washington, because they always are, they always have been, to help pay for this. And this is the financial model in which they operate. They've never had to make their state financially self-sufficient. They could always mess it up and look forward to a bailout from Washington, and that money is drying up. Eventually, it's not going to be worth anything.
It sounds like one of the things that you would be doing as a Vermont state senator certainly is putting legislation out there to demand that these corporations that are stealing resources from Vermont would be paying their fair share, right?
Well, that's it. You send them a bill. And,
right.
Of course, there's the scare tactics. Oh, they'll shut down. Oh, they'll leave Vermont. But the truth is that any skilled workers that they have, they brought in. Large corporations typically travel with their own workforce, especially in resource extraction. And the truth is that the resources are just going to stay there. The water's going to stay in the ground. The marble's going to stay in the ground. It's not going anywhere.
Right.
So, I mean, those are just scare tactics. But, yeah, they have to be sent a tax bill. And if they are, what we'll see is that our resources have a market value, and it will then become profitable for smaller corporations, hopefully Vermont-based, to start up and make a profit and be productive. We have to work up our materials locally rather than send them out of state.
We have a question here. We have one question from Scott, who emails and says, how will Vermont budget up for services if it succeeds? Can you speak to that?
Sure. Well, Vermont, according to the National Tax Foundation, is a net receiver state. And what that means is that for every dollar of taxes that are extracted from Vermont to go to Washington, that $1.08 come back to Vermont. So, yes, with current budget levels, Scott's right, there's no way. We have to look at historic budgets, which I have done, and I've noticed a very clear historical trend from the loss of home rule in 1962 to the state taking powers and responsibilities and authority away from the towns, and our budget has ballooned like crazy. So central planning is at fault, central control, and a huge bureaucracy in Montpelier, the capital of Vermont, to oversee all of these powers that were taken away from localities. It's not more efficient. We can save a lot of money by devolving powers back to the towns, back where they belong, and reinstituting home rule. At that point, we can happily be a state or not be a state, because we truly do not know what the future holds.
Right. Well, speaking of the future and the present, of course, how do you intend to help Vermont prepare for collapse? Because, you know, you've just gotten a taste of it with it with the damage of Irene. How do you intend to really help the state of Vermont prepare for these very uncertain things that are likely to be confronting us in the next few years?
Well, firstly, we have to understand the uncertainty. This is not something that's understood in the halls of power at the present moment. But if I walk on the street, I hear it from just about everybody. So the first is that awareness of getting people into the legislature who understand what's going on and who are concerned about the survival of Vermont. You know, where are the jobs going to come from? Where's the capital investment? So the first thing that we have to look at is Vermont's public money, which is still worth something. But since 9/11, many states and municipalities have thrown their public money into Wall Street. That was a kind of a hidden bailout, and they did rather well, but it's a huge risk for a state to be putting pension funds and public money in Wall Street. So what I would do is follow the North Dakota model and bring it home, invest and put it in either a state bank for local reinvestment in capital projects, or in local banks and credit union. Again, they would have to place the money in Vermont, and presto changeo, Vermont now has working capital, whereas before it did not. So we need capital projects, we need infrastructure, durable infrastructure, the kind of bridges that they built in the 1920s, and even after almost a century of neglect, we're still driving over these bridges. So we need durable infrastructure, we need local transport and distribution, and we need extreme decentralization of authority.
And also, I have a question for you around that in terms of food supply and food security for Vermont in the face of, you know, what is becoming increasingly questionable food supply around the world, skyrocketing food prices, climate change that is going to continue to devastate agriculture. How would you help Vermonters prepare in that department?
This is an area where the legislature has to consider nullification of many of the USDA's regulations, because the Vermont farmer is basically has his hands tied around his back. He's told where to plant what, where the seeds come from, and what the price is going to be. That has to go. There's a tremendous amount of money coming in to convert food, land that formerly produced food, over to oil, genetically modified GMO Monsanto oil seeds for biofuels. Stuff like that has to go, and we have to stop we have to stop subsidizing these things. You know, Carolyn, you hear the word food system and food security parlayed a lot. Well, when I went to school, I learned about a food chain, and then our teachers told us, well, it's really a food web. Technically, it's a food web. This is not something that you can plan from above or take from one area to benefit another area. Stalin tried that, and the net result was that, besides all the bloodshed, was that and famines, was that people produced as little as possible because they had no incentive. And you know, by the end, by the time the Soviet Union collapsed, most of the food in the Soviet Union was produced in little kitchen gardens. The big ag in the Soviet Union was essentially defunct. Same thing happened in Cuba, and the same thing has to happen in Vermont. There is no food system, and nobody should be able to tell a farmer what to do.
Right. So how would you then make sure that there is sufficient food for the state? Because this is going to be a huge issue.
Well, other than government getting out of the food business, where we can't afford to be and don't have the competence to begin with, we have to remove the barriers to economic opportunity for farmers. We have to remove subsidies for development so that land becomes cheaper. We have to shift taxes off of our farmers, shift regulation off of our farmers so that local areas can produce food, can do the on-farm slaughter, can produce and distribute milk. I'm involved with an organization called the Coalition for Food Sovereignty, where we're actually writing legislation to guarantee that Vermont has food sovereignty, that no one can come and take it away or tell us that we're part of a larger system now, and we have to produce quotas of this and quotas of that for somewhere else. And Vermont has to think of our people first.
We have a question coming in here, Robert, very interesting, from Jeff, who asks, does Vermont currently have any local alternative currencies, and or has there been any talk of accepting gold and silver as currency?
Well, currency is whatever is accepted. It's a circular definition, but whatever is accepted is currency. Things haven't quite gotten that bad yet. We're in some of the areas harder hit by Irene. People have either reverted to gift economy or barter and refusing to accept cash for anything. If alternative currencies, local currencies, have caught on in different parts of the U.S., for example, the plenty in North Carolina, but it hasn't quite caught on here yet.
Uh-huh. Okay, I wanted to also ask you a question about, you've got this horrible thing sitting there on the Connecticut River called Vermont Yankee. What do you see needs to be done about that?
That needs to be closed and gotten rid of as soon as possible before we lose the capability of getting rid of it at all.
I should clarify, it's a nuclear power plant.
Yes, thank you. Vermont Yankee is among the last of a generation of reactors that have long been shut down. Maine had a Yankee reactor, and it's GE Mark III, I believe. Maine had one. It came to the end of its life cycle. The plant was shut down, and the area was returned to green field. There was no spike in energy prices, and all the scare tactics failed to materialize. However, the one in Vermont is highly subsidized right by Vermont, so it's bigger profit. It's run by a corporation in Louisiana, Entergy, that's running it into the ground. And they're working with the NRC to try to force it to remain open regardless. This thing has been leaking into our groundwater, and it uses the Connecticut River as a heat sink, pays nothing in taxes, and it truly is a huge, huge risk, and it needs to go.
Yes, I know. When I was living in Vermont a couple of years ago, that I had a number of friends, and along with myself, who were protesting vigorously against Yankee and wanting to shut it down. Now, I thought that it had been voted to shut, that there was a vote to shut it down.
No, actually, there was an act in the legislature, Act 160, that gave the legislature the power to be the final arbiter of whether the 20-year license gets renewed or not, the operating license. That act says that it needs to be a combined vote of both houses of the legislature, at which point it is final. The legislature did not vote. There was a vote in the Senate on denying relicense, but that vote wasn't binding because it didn't mean anything. The entire legislature has to vote for Act 160 to take effect. So what I find it very interesting is that there are now, you know, a bunch of people who ran for office claiming to be anti-nuclear are now hedging their bets because they're afraid of what might happen if we lost this huge source of electricity. We have to deal with Hydro-Quebec, and they're not seeing the elephant in the room. The elephant in the room is Vermont's dams. The legislature gave away Vermont's dams at fire sale prices to TransCanada Corporation, and TransCanada Corporation cut the wires to Vermont and used Vermont's dams to provide power for Massachusetts. They pay no taxes. So I went over the numbers on this, and there's $400 or $500 million a year in windfall. This is potential revenue for the state if they taxed TransCanada. And what windfall means is that say a company makes a $250 million investment, and they make $1 billion. Okay. Another $250 million on that might be considered the legitimate returns on capital investment. That'll make anybody happy, make the stockholders happy. However, anything over and above that is, any revenue over and above that is considered windfall, and that's what should be taxed.
Right.
So Vermont should be taxing the dams that are now privately owned and operated. That's where the electricity comes from.
Why aren't, you know, I just have to ask, why aren't the people more proactive in taxing these corporations that are coming in and taking resources, and these electric companies that are taking power? I mean, I understand the fear that they might lose jobs, and you said that's really kind of not a real issue. We got to get some fire in the belly here in Vermont to these folks. And you know, you guys are tough people. And it's really time to stand up and fight for your sovereignty.
Well, that sovereignty is it, and it's that's the exact word I'm thinking of. But doing two things. One is I've organized a 30 for the Senate campaign, and what that means is the Vermont Senate has 30 seats, which is a doable project, you know, finding 30 people. It's not hundreds of people. So to this project to run, to get 30 people running for every seat in the entire legislature is making, it's beginning to make a splash. And on that wave, now we're talking about real issues. You know, where's our money going? Where are our jobs coming from? Where's our energy coming from? How do things work?
Right.
You know, get people involved. Hold us, you know, hold us all accountable. If I'm running for public office, I work for you.
Right.
I need to hear from you. You need to be engaged, and you need to hold your representatives accountable. That hasn't happened yet, but I think we're getting a good start here. And Irene, as terrible as it was in providing a dress rehearsal for collapse, I think is maybe shocked people out of a reverie where, in which, you know, to save the planet, you're going to have to do more than just buy a bunch of green products.
Right. Right. So your campaign has begun, and what exactly are you doing these days to take it out there?
Well, I ran in 2010 for the Vermont Senate. We have legislative elections every 2 years here in Vermont. And 2010, no money, just a quiet guy, no party backing, running as an independent, complete unknown. I was really surprised to earn 8% of the vote for the Senate seat that I was contesting.
Uh-huh.
It was a great honor, you know, 1,300 votes. I didn't have any ads. I got no media coverage. The media were ignoring us and concentrating on the Democrats. So, you know, what was it? What did I do? And all I really did was I talked to people. I pounded the pavements, talked to people, listened to them, mostly listened.
Right.
And they were so surprised that someone would be patiently listening and trying to learn. You know, I'd come into a meeting of, you know, in a nursing home, say, look, I'm here to learn, and can you tell me what's going on here?
Well, Robert, we're running out of time, and I am so looking forward to being with all of you in Vermont September 21st through 25th. I can't wait to get there and be with you folks again. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us tonight. I'm so grateful for all that you are doing and your colleagues are doing in Vermont and the way the people are pulling together after this horrible disaster. So thank you so much for being with us tonight on the Lifeboat Hour.
Thank you, Carolyn.